And yo, Black, it's time.
Word, it's time, man. It's time, man.
All right, begin.
I got to talk. I got to tell what I feel. I got to talk about my life as I see it.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I like to know.
Are you ready for start time?
Yeah. Okay, well, let me kind of move these things around here, you know.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what this is coming down through the audience, but look like he just came out of the basement.
You know what I'm saying?
Thank you, because now...
Get ready.
Yeah. We dedicate this to these people out here getting banged.
Because only one thing counts in this life. Get them to sign on the line which is dotted.
And I own this $500 million shiny suit.
Looking like a bag of money.
Because you drove a Hyundai to get here tonight. I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name.
You see this watch? That watch costs more than your car. I made $970,000 last year. How much you make?
Somebody in the house say yeah. If y'all really like to rock the funky beats, somebody in the house say hell yeah. I like that for the people up top. Check this out.
A, B, C. A always, B, B, C closing. Always be closing. Always be closing. If you want to work here, close.
Okay, I'm reloaded.
Biggie Smalls is the illest. Biggie Smalls is the illest. Biggie Smalls is the illest. Biggie Smalls is the illest.
From the sports bars to the stands, we are the voice of the fans. You are now plugged into your sports mixtape. This is the Section 357 show, the Ball Street Journal, where we always have the best seats in the house. You are plugged in with your Ball Street Journal reporters, D, Floyd, Ron, and L.A. Trey. Fellas, how you doing?
Doing absolutely fantastic. What a show we have lined up today. We've got all of our Ball Street Journal reporters on here, and we're truly taking sports outside the borders onto a field that you rarely hear talked about. But before we get there, let me toss it over to my man, Ronnie. How you doing?
Thank you, D, for that wonderful greeting, as always. It is truly an honor to have the guest we have on today, Key Smart, Olympian fencer, straight out of Flatbush, Brooklyn, join the show today. But before we bring him into the conversation, we got to take it out to the west side, somewhere between San Bernardino and San Diego. It's my main man, L.A. Trey. Trey, what's going on, man?
What's going on, fellas? I hear we got an Olympian in the building. I couldn't be any happier. Look, fencing is just one of those things that I used to always tune into. I may not necessarily know everything there is about fencing, but I appreciate the skill that's involved in the sport. Let's get this thing started.
On with the Section 357 show, we have Olympic silver medalist, three-time Olympian, as well as national champion in men's saber fencing, Keith Smart. Keith, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. This is quite an honor. I'm looking forward to chatting with you guys.
Keith, thank you for coming on with us. Keith, I have a personal question, if I may start off with that. Where do you keep your silver medal? Where is the medal right now?
It's actually, I have a very small trophy cabinet in my apartment in Brooklyn, and I keep it in a case in the trophy cabinet. Over the years, I've acquired a lot of bigger trophies and stuff, which is at various family members' homes. But the silver medal, I don't let it go too far away from me.
Keith, let's just kind of start at the beginning. You know, a fencer from Brooklyn is not exactly something you hear about every day, much less an African-American fencer from Brooklyn. So what got the fencing bug to you? Was it just kind of playing, you know, with swords like every kid did as a youngster? What got the fencing bug started?
It's a great question. So before I started fencing, I never knew anything about it other than Star Wars, you know, like I never met a fencer before. I never met an Olympian before. And I was like the typical kid growing up in Brooklyn. I grew up in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and basically everybody just plays basketball 24 hours a day. And I did the same thing until one day my dad, who also grew up in Brooklyn and was a really good basketball player, saw me play, and he's like, look, you're good, but you're not great. Why don't you try this new program that's called fencing out at the Peter Westrick Foundation, which designed just for kids from New York City to introduce specifically black people to fencing. And I at first I was hesitant because I didn't know anything about it and none of my friends were doing it. But when I went to the program, the Peter Westrick Foundation, I saw all these other black Olympians from around the country. And they looked like they were having so much fun. And I was hooked from that day on, and I've never turned around since. That was in 1991.
Keith, this is Derek. I want to touch on that a little bit. And forgive me, this is going to be a bit of a tough question, but we talked about in our pre-show meeting how President Obama was down at Morehouse this weekend, and in part of his speech, he talked about how African-American males have to be great African-American males, but at the same time do more than just for the African-American community. Now, you were the first American fencer to gain a number one ranking, or the first American male fencer, I should say, to gain a number one ranking. So naturally, because you're the first American, it also makes you the first African-American. How do you balance those two things about being a great American in your sport and representing your country? And I'm certainly the biggest USA homer on this show, but balancing being an American star athlete and an African-American star athlete.
That's a good question. It's interesting. When I first started competing internationally, the American team, we always knew, like, you know, we band together like a band of brothers, because if you're going to a foreign country, all the Americans kind of gravitate towards each other. But it wasn't until I really started going to Eastern Europe, in places like Poland and Ukraine, where they'd never seen a black person before, or maybe they saw them on TV, and they would just come up to me and, like, stare at me. And I was like, oh, wow, like, this is really new to a lot of people. And then when I was in New York or training all the time, I always wanted to be a role model to other kids that look like me that are African-American, because I know, like, it's not easy being different in our community. You know, like, it's kind of a group mentality. If everybody wants to be a rapper, then, you know, everybody in high school is practicing rap beats and so on and so forth. And for me, it was like, all right, you know, my parents were really good at saying it's okay to be different, it's okay to go against the grain, and give me that confidence. So once I was old enough to be an example, I made it a passion to just kind of give back all the time, letting people know, like, there's many different ways to succeed in the community, and it doesn't just have to be through the two most common things that you see. There are, like, a host of people doing amazing things that are African American. So embrace that opportunity and run with it.
Hello, Keith. I'm Trey, Trey Murphy, and I'm really curious about your Olympic career and with most Olympic athletes. I've always wanted to know, is there something that the Olympics brings to your specific sport that you would not have expected, be it a different fighting style or adjusting to the culture of the Olympics themselves or a level of readiness to prepare for such a large global scale? What can you tell me about the unexpected?
So the thing that makes the Olympics unique is, in terms of the actual competition itself, regardless of what sport it is, it's usually the smallest competition. So if you look at like a world championships or a World Cup in, I don't know, any given sport, they might have, let's say, 100 athletes in there. But the Olympics, because they want to keep the field of play small and intense, there might only be 50 people in that particular sport. So what makes it really unique is the intensity. So every match, you're going against a person that is obviously the best in their country, but also could win the tournament because of the way the requirements to qualify for the Olympics. So so essentially, in other tournaments, you can kind of like skate by fencing a scrub or running against somebody that's not as fast until you get to the final round. But in the Olympics, it's very rare where you're meeting someone that isn't a top-tier athlete. At the same time, the thing that you have to figure out how to balance is the pressure. Because it's a tournament that's only once every 4 years, there's an immense amount of pressure placed on all of the athletes, and everyone is aware of it. So in the Olympic Village, I always like to tell people it's like living in a college campus where everybody's studying for the same final, but only 1% of the people is going to get an A and pass the class. So you have that level of intensity where, you know, you might know someone for 10 years and they're just so focused, they won't even say hi to you at the meal hall. So you kind of have to, like, for first-time Olympians, it's a bit of a shock to their system where they're dealing with this level of intensity. So, I would say the level of intensity as well as the strength of the competition are the two biggest challenges that you face at the Olympics.
Keith, I wanted to get your perspective on being involved in a sport where you're still having to balance quote-unquote regular life on a much different type of scale than, let's say, a basketball player or an NFL player, because you live a regular life. You have a job. You've had things that go on outside of saber fencing. You got your MBA from Columbia. I think your sister recently got her MBA from Wharton, so congrats to her. So I wanted to get your perspective on balancing those things, you know, balancing both sides of that equation in terms of Keith Smart, the fencer, or Aaron Smart, the fencer, and the regular person living in the world.
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's balancing the two, because in Europe, if we were representing Italy or France or, you know, Hungary, we'd be professional athletes the same way you'd see a Williams sister or a Tiger Woods or someone like that. Because fencing there is the number one sport in a lot of countries. So we have to train in America like we're professionals. And what that requires is essentially training 6 days a week. Each practice is 4 to 5 hours a day. But when I was training and working, my routine was really structured, and essentially I lived like a monk. I would get to work by 8, leave by 5, and be at practice by 5:30, and I wouldn't leave practice till about 10 o'clock at night, because I knew I couldn't practice any less than my European competitors. But at the same time, I still had to balance paying for my bills and expenses living in New York. So you end up living very regimented in terms of you miss a lot of social occasions, like going out with friends for dinners and movies, watching TV, like, you know, bonding over those things, where or going to weddings and so forth, because you have one goal. And we were trained like that from this time we started fencing. It's like our goal is only to make the Olympics, and that's it's laser focused. So, you know, like the year at the minute the previous Olympic Games ends, you start training for 4 years for the next one. And once you tell everyone your goal, it's a little easier to have people manage their expectations of when you're gonna be able to hang out with them versus when you can't. But it's a constant struggle, and that's the biggest challenge with American amateur athletes. And there's a variety of sports in America where we're constantly struggling because we lose these athletes that can't figure out how to balance their regular life with their training life because of the needs of, like, supporting themselves.
Keith, this is Derek again, and I'd like to follow up on that a little bit. I was talking before the show how you seem to be the poster child for this NCAA campaign that most of our athletes go pro in another sport. I just want you to talk about how you feel about NCAA athletics. I know your goal is to be an Olympian, so this might not apply to you, but whether or not college athletes should be paid, and more importantly, the focus back on what you were talking about earlier, and the struggle and the grind that you've gone through, which is in many ways similar, if not worse, than like a star NCAA football player. But one could argue, due to your Olympic success, you've had more success than a lot of star college football or basketball players.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question because I did compete in the NCAAs for fencing. I went to St. John's on a fencing scholarship or athletic scholarship for fencing. So I was forced to adhere to the same rules that all of the top or the popular college sports guys have to follow. And everyone knows the rules from day one. And when I was at St. John's, they had a big NCAA violation with the basketball team in regards to, like, a couple of guys were taking money from boosters for cars and so forth. And I was friends with those guys. And essentially, we all came from the same neighborhood. And I explained to them, I was like, look, this is your life. Yeah, the rules are a little draconian in terms of, like, you know, you can't, if somebody offers to pay a meal for you, who's going to turn down a free meal? But at the same time, you have to look at the big picture. I do think there's a large conflict of interest with the NCAA because it goes across all the sports. They'll sell a T-shirt with, like, my image on it at a fencing championship, but I won't receive a penny from that sale. And I know it's a bigger problem with college football and college basketball. Like, you see, I was just at the Final Four. I'm seeing all of these fans wear various jerseys of people, and yet, you know, not one of those athletes are getting a dime. And I know, like, Ed O'Bannon from the UCLA championship team is trying to fight the NCAA on that. So I think they should, if not a salary, a stipend. College athletes should at least receive a stipend that's equivalent to, you know, $5,000 per month, something that any wealthy kid receives from their parents at college, which I think people are, like, they're not keeping it in perspective. Because for just speaking from a personal standpoint, when I was in college and, you know, you're scraping by, and then some of my friends who are on the fencing team, and it's traditionally a team filled with kids that come from a lot of money, they're driving around in a brand new BMW and so forth, and I'm, like, you know, riding a bicycle. So and I'm sure that exists on every college campus. So it's a matter of making sure these athletes that are bringing in the revenue are fairly compensated. They don't need to receive $1 million paycheck, but I think at least a stipend. But on the other hand, they should be aware of the rules, and you just got to play the rules until the game has changed a little bit.
Keith, you talk about being different in the African American community, and that goes in a lot of areas, not just sports. Obviously, you have your meet of Peter Westbrook, Peter Westbrook Foundation, but who else, maybe in fencing, outside of fencing, was also served as an inspiration? Because I'm sure, obviously, you're a kid, Brooklyn, Flatbush, and now you're playing fencing. I'm sure that, you know, people are kind of giving you the side eye a few times, but who, other than maybe a Peter Westbrook, kind of kept you saying, hey, stick with it. You know, it may not be like the quote-unquote cool thing to do, but this is something you're really good at and stick with it. Who were some of those inspirations? Because I'm sure while you enjoy the sport, that probably is tough being different in so many ways.
Yeah, it's a great point. Well, my parents first were really big factors in why I stayed with it and why my sister stayed with it. And then I would add, we had the chance to meet Arthur Ashe, the great tennis star, during the early days of the Peter Westwick Foundation. He came by to a few sessions, and I remember speaking with him, and it just, you know, like, man, I've only read about you in, like, the encyclopedia and stuff. And he was like, look, just stick with this sport. It's, you know, who knows where it'll lead you guys, but it's okay to be different. And to me, that, like, just blew my mind. Like, this guy, first thing, he came to a fencing gym, and then second, he literally went around speaking to each one of us kids there and just giving us little words of inspiration. So that was really nice. And then I drew, like, inspiration from historical references. A big one for me at the time was Jackie Robinson, just because, you know, Brooklyn and, like, Ebbets Field was where it used to be, was a few blocks away from where I grew up. So everyone used to walk around with, like, Jackie Robinson throwback jerseys and so forth. So that was nice, just reading about his story and so forth. They also allowed me to kind of, like, stick with it, even though, like, most of my friends, they just didn't understand why I was fencing like it. But they kind of, like, started to relax once I got a chance to travel around the country, and they were still in Brooklyn.
This is Trey again, and one of the things that annoys me sometimes when it comes to African Americans in sports is that many assume that we get where we are because of our physical dominance, per se. And yet that does hold true in many sports. You have some people like LeBron James, who's just physically dominant at what he does. You have Venus Williams and Serena Williams, who are just physically kind of dominant at what they do. But a lot of times, the intelligence and the finesse that's involved in these sports is overlooked on us. Fencing, to me, and I could be wrong, doesn't seem like it's as physically domineering as, say, something like football. So, in order for you to become great at what you've done, what aspect of fencing is the most necessary in order to succeed? Is it the finesse and the intelligence, or in this case, does it have to be a physical type of dominance in order for you to be as successful as you are?
Trey, that's a very interesting question, because it's a combination of a few things. You do need some basic level of athletic ability, but you don't have to be the LeBron James, the Shaquille O'Neals of the world, because that actually will hinder you in fencing. But you have to be somewhat coordinated. The thing I think that I benefited more than anything else was the discipline and determination. There's a lot of intelligence. We, as fencers, we like to call the sport physical chess, because you're always thinking 2 to 3 moves ahead, and then you're also keeping a database of all the moves that someone might have done to you in the past, and the potential that they can do them to you in the future. But where I excelled over everyone else, keeping those things equal, meaning my intelligence and my athletic ability, was I basically worked harder than everyone else in practice, and that's what I was known for. I would be the first one in and the last one out. And even today, I teach a fencing workshop, or, you know, a class with the Peter Westwick Foundation and fitness class, and I'm always the first one there, and I'm also, like, the last one to leave. So I give it 110% every time. And that was the thing that really helped my career and my sister's career go through the roof, was we worked much harder than all of our teammates, who were definitely more talented than us. And these are, like, white athletes that had access to a lot more resources in terms of, you know, personal trainers and home gyms and so forth. But at the end of the day, there's no substitute for just putting in the work in practice. And then, you know, coupled with our level of understanding of the sport, like the intelligence of, like, studying the former great fencers and so forth, so you can learn from that. But we were just really passionate about outworking everyone.
Let's take a quick pause
play some music, a little bit of Brooklyn flavor, and we'll be right back with our guest, Keith Smart. This is the Section 357 show.
Fresh trim at 400 J got the Tim rack. Blue collars, metro carton in. Thugs mobbing in. Form partnership, increase armament. Street former says deep consequence. When you seek sleek ornaments, you get caught. Rode the white horse and can't get off. Big dogs that trick off just get sent off. They shoebox dashes, all they see is gotta live off. It's real, yo, but still, yo, it's love here. And it's felt by anybody to come here. Out of town, let's take the train, plane, and bus here. Must be something that they really want here. 1 year as a resident, deep in sentiment. They shout out, go Brooklyn, they representing it. Sitting on they front stoop, sipping Guinnesses. Using native dialect in they sentences. From the tree line blocks to the tenements. To the mom and pop local shop businesses. But travel all around the world at great distances. It ain't a place that I know that bear resemblance. That's why we call it the planet. Not a borough or a province. Our style is uncommon. From some to the tomb, against the Lafayette Gardens. White Cove, Gowanus, and the Army Jack Atlantis. Yo, this goes out to my cats in Coney Isle. Friday night out in front of the Himalaya going wild. This goes out to Crown Heights and Smurf Village. The 90s, and all my yard in Trinity Brown's Village. Parkside, tennis court, 30s, 40s, and the 50s. The cats out in Star Right City getting busy. To the hook, to the east, to the stop. Bushwick and Canarsie. Farragut, Fort Greene, and Marcy. My Flatbush posse, generals and armies. When it's time to form, just call me. And let this song be playing loud and long be. If you love Bucktown strongly, raise it up. Brooklyn, my habitat, the place where I happen at. Loud sway in the sharp balance of the battle axe. Irons is brandished at, thugs draw their hammer back. It's where you find the news, tool, crew, cameras at. It's where my fam is at, the summertime jam is at. They play big and get you open like a sandalback. Hot in the candle wax, hustling and you can't relax. The crack babies trying to find where they mamas at. It's off the handle black with big police scandals at. Turning the action screenplay, so the Miramax. The type of place where they check your appearance at. And cats who know where all the hot no gear is at. The stomping grounds where you find a pound smokers that be blazing charm to have your wave cap floating back. The doorstep where the dispossessed posted at. Dope fiends out on Franklin Ave selling Zover racks. You big baller better keep your money folded back. Cause once the young guns notice that it's over black, Brooklyn keep on taking it. Worldwide we known for that. Floor seat cats get it snatched like the local tax. The place I sharpen up my baritone vocals at. But one of the greatest MCs was a local.
I want to take this. Well, this is a two-part question, if you will. The last time we saw each other, I believe it was on the BQ train coming from Manhattan going into Brooklyn.
That was the last time I think
we saw each other, and I was surprised to see you on the train. I was like, Keith is really from Brooklyn, like Brooklyn, right? So I want to ask you, A, what is it like to be the best in the world at something? That's a very rare air for anyone to inhabit. So what is it like to be the best in the world? You were the number one ranking male. What does it mean to be that? What does it feel like when you reflect on that? But then B, from a hip-hop question, Brooklyn is the home of many a great MC. Who is the best Brooklyn MC in your opinion?
All right. Well, I'll go with the best in the world in fencing first, because that's the easier question. I think it's an honor when I think back upon all the success I've had. Especially given that Americans weren't known as great fencers, and I was like part of this Renaissance era where we like really broke through the ranks. And then when I achieved the number one ranking and then winning a silver medal at the Olympics. These are things that I get letters from fans all over the world till this day, and where they're still in shock that an American did this. It's the equivalent of, like, you know, some expansion franchise winning the championship in, like, their third year. A lot of Europeans that are fans of fencing for decades, they just still don't understand how, like, a kid from Brooklyn could have such success. So whenever I receive notes like that, it really hits home. It's like, wow, I've achieved a lot, and I've been very blessed, and I'm very fortunate. So it really warms my heart to know that if you put in the hard work, you can achieve your goals, and there isn't a dream that's too big that you can achieve. So that's always nice to know, because I take that experience with me in other aspects of life, where you can just set goals, and, you know, it might seem insurmountable, but if you keep chipping away at it, you'll eventually reach the top of the mountain. Now, in terms of Brooklyn hip-hop, so, yeah, I grew up in Flatbush, and at the time when I was growing up in, like, the early to mid-90s, everybody, like, basically claimed rappers from their neighborhood. So if you had asked me this question 20 years ago, I would have said Special Ed, but many people don't even know who he is now, so because he was from Flatbush, and everybody loved him just because he had one or two songs. But I think right now I would have to say Biggie, with Jay-Z a close second. The only reason why I say Biggie is, if you take Biggie's two albums, Ready to Die and Life After Death, none of those Puffy-produced posthumous albums, but just the ones that he was involved in from start to finish, and you take Jay-Z's best two albums, whichever ones you want to do, like Reasonable Doubt versus the Black Album, I think Life After Death and Ready to Die definitely beats Ready to Die definitely beats Reasonable Doubt, and I don't think Jay-Z has an album that can beat Life After Death. So that's why I got to stick with Biggie.
Keith, this is Trey. Another question. I heard you mention earlier that when somebody brought up fencing, the first thing that kind of popped in your head was Star Wars. And honestly, I remember being a kid grabbing a stick in my front yard and pretending that I was Luke Skywalker fighting Darth Vader. So I'm curious, if you're that, I don't know, 10-year-old kid and you're got that stick in your hand, is there anybody real or fictional that you would want to sword fight / fence, who would it be?
Oh, wow. I would love to try and fence Darth Vader, because he's pretty strong. When I look at Star Wars now, I just see all the technical mistakes that they make as fencers. So it's like, oh, okay, you know, I could hit him with this move or that move in my mind. So I don't think Luke would be a challenge to me. So given that, I think Darth Vader, just because of his strength, I'd like to go up against somebody that's like, whatever, 6'5", and just has all that strength and experience to see whether I could, like, outmaneuver him and use my speed against him.
Keith, I wanted to ask one last question, because I remember reading an article that I believe you posted, perhaps, I believe, where you talked about some strategies or some attributes that fencing kind of enhances. I want to get your perspective on how some of the attributes of fencing really do translate for you into real life.
For me, I think there's a few things that I've gathered from fencing that I can use in my daily life. And first, it's overcoming adversity. In fencing, you're losing 10 times more than you're winning, and it's happening all the time. And that's the case in life. Like, you know, every day you might not get that great sale or promotion or whatever, and you just got to understand that you got to keep grinding it out, go back to the drawing board sometimes, and you know, reapply yourself. A lot of people quit too early, and that was the most important thing, like, that I drew from the article is, like, you know, as fencers, we have a unique perspective because you're dealing with so many losses, so much adversity, that you're able to kind of, like, keep things in perspective and say, okay, there's a reason why I lost. You can take a step back and look at the situation versus dwelling in the immediate reaction of the loss. Then the other thing is it's a very technical sport. It requires people to be detailed oriented if you want to succeed, meaning you have to have the discipline as well as the perfectionism to hit a spot on the wall 100 times in a row. Most people will get bored and frustrated after like 10 times just trying to hit a spot on the wall. Imagine trying to, you know, taking a pen and hitting the same spot over and over again 100 times in a row. And in fencing, if you want to make it to the top, if a coach tells you to hit the spot 1,000 times in a row, and if you mess up at number 999 and you have to start at zero, you're like, okay, yeah, I messed up at 999. Let's start at zero again. So having that perfectionism and detail-oriented trait has really helped me as I work in more like my day-to-day life, just not being not willing to accept mediocrity is important. And then the last thing that I would say is really important that I gathered from fencing is every time you go to a tournament, you never know who you're going to fence. That's the thing that I love about the sport, and the thing that scares a lot of people about the sport is that on any given day, you might be going up against somebody new that's different, that studied you, that is just like, you know, a real, a huge talent. And being able to adapt to all the different circumstances where people are constantly changing their moves, their styles on the fly. And you have to, if you want to succeed, you have to adapt quickly, be willing to throw out your original game plan and take a new game plan just because, you know, life isn't guaranteed. You might have a plan in place for like a wedding or whatever, and then if it falls through, you have to, how do you like roll with the punches? So those are the three things that I found to have carried me throughout life that I gained from fencing.
Keith, as we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to talk about the foundation you work for, any fencing site that people might want to reach out and connect to, any type of social any type of social media information where people can reach out to you or the foundation, anything that you want to plug, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you. So first, I'd invite everyone to visit the Peter Westbrook Foundation if they're in New York City. I coach there every Saturday morning. It's 150 kids from all parts of New York. You know, we don't charge any tuition, which is unheard of in fencing, so everything is free. Our website is peterwestbrook.org. And if anyone, and I'm always willing to share my advice and give tips and whatever, or just keep in touch with people, and they could just look for me on Twitter. That's the easiest way. I've been getting into that recently. So my Twitter name is Keith Smart, KeithSmart, and that's all you have to do, at Keith Smart, and I'll get back to you right away. So, but I really enjoyed this interview. Thank you for the invitation and the time.
Keith, again, thank you for coming on to the show. Thank you for sharing your words of wisdom. We look forward to having you on again, so feel free. You have an open invitation, if you will, to come back onto the show, and we always look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much. I look forward to keeping in touch with you guys, and enjoy the rest of your day.
It's about that time. The last call here on the Section 357 show as we wrap up. Once again, big thanks to Keith Smart for stopping in with us. Fellas, let's just take it around the horn. Your last thoughts. Trey, I'm going to send it out there to you first.
My last call goes out to Titus Young. In case you haven't been keeping up, Titus Young used to be a wide receiver for the Detroit Lions, and he somehow found his way to get arrested twice in one day, then a couple of days later get arrested again, and then maybe 3 or 4 days later after that get arrested one more time. I got to give a shout out to Floyd because he actually checked me on it because I was clowning him at first because I'm like, yo, who is this idiot? Why does he keep getting into trouble over and over again? I threw him under the bus, and Floyd brought up a very good point. He said, you know, this young man may have some problems, some mental health issues as to why he keeps getting into trouble. Lo and behold, maybe a few days after his final incident, his ex-girlfriend files a restraining order against him because she was fearful for her life. Titus Young's father made an announcement and said that, yes, my son has mental issues. He's already been checked in before. This brother needs help. And here I am laughing, clowning at this young man, and it made me check myself for a second and realize that there's always more to the story than what you see. Don't get me wrong. There's knuckleheads out there. But you have to really take a moment and not judge as quickly as I did. So, you know, prayers, shouts out, thoughts out, whatever it is that you do. Mine go out to Titus Young. You know, I really hope he gets his life together. And just another shout out to Floyd for humbling me for a second. And so that's my last call. Titus, man, I hope you get it together, brother.
Last call for alcohol or something like it. D, what do you have, man?
My last call goes out to horse racing. We're not gamblers on this show, so we don't talk about horse racing outside of the Triple Crown. And with all the steroids, all the cheating that goes on in the sports, for another year, nobody cares about whatever the third race is because we don't have a potential Triple Crown winner now that horse chances have been messed up thanks to Oxbow winning the Preakness. Come on, horse racing. If you're going to be corrupt, at least give us something to care about in the Triple Crown.
Last call for alcohol or something like it. What do you have, Ron?
My last call goes to the show that wrapped up this past week, and that scandal. Just when I thought I had it figured out, I don't know what I'm looking at anymore. And that's a good thing. A brilliant way to end the show. Some nice twists and turns, closed a couple things, left a couple things open. So looking forward already to the next season of Scandal. Big shout out to Shonda Rhimes, keeping me glued to the set to the very end. Floyd, take us home as usual.
All right, guys. For my last call, as always, we give a big thanks to our fans out there. Check us out on Twitter at Section 357. Find us as well on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, the Stitcher app for mobile devices, and just connect with us as well as please pass the word. We always appreciate new listeners, new followers, and great conversation on social media. So with that being said, best of luck to you and your favorite sports teams out there, wherever you might be. This is the Section 357 show, where we always have the best seats in the house. Until next time, take care.